This.
Hey, how you doing? What are you doing? Hey, how you doing? Hey, how you doing?
Is Felger and Mads.
What?
On 98.5.
Unbelievable.
The Sports Hub.
Mads and Murray and Stu are happily back in our Town Fair Tire Studios in Brighton.
I wouldn't call it dysfunction. I would call it tension amongst the show right now.
We're continuing with your calls. Something, a small rodent crawled up Jimmy's backside today because he's been working out some sort of something that has crawled up his buttocks.
It's called you being needy on remote. That's what it's called.
And so,
Jimmy, punch up the sound here. Punch up this call. Meh, 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 meh.
It's a big underlying tension on the program.
I just told Jimmy, I told Murray off the air, I can't decide who's been the bigger a-hole in the last 24 hours, Rondo or Jimmy?
Me.
Okay, we've got Red Sox stuff, we've got some Celtics stuff, never mind the Celtics sucking, you know, we somehow got wrapped up in this Real Housewives of the NBA bullcrap, and I keep forgetting to give away the Pearl Jam tickets. I'll do it this segment, I promise. If I go to break without giving away the Pearl Jam tickets, Jimmy Stewart has the right to find me and slap me across the face with his hand, with the back of his hand. Okay? Pearl Jam tickets this segment. We'll continue with your Celtics thoughts. We did get wrapped up in the Rondo Isaiah Thomas thing, but the Celtics have been sucking. Are they not the team you thought they were? That's one of our Celtics thoughts, and we're doing Red Sox as well with Alex Cora, again, meeting the media today in Fort Myers and saying some, I don't know, some interesting things. Jimmy, I apologize, but I am clogged up on my screen, so I need line one. Kyle in Providence popped up here on the Red Sox. Go ahead, Kyle. What do you got? Kyle?
Hey, guys. So, yeah, calling about Alex Cora. So this is what I think. The guy's going to come in. He's going to be the cool stepdad. He's going to buy him candy. He's going to take him a Chuck E. Cheese. That's all going to be good and well. They're going to love the guy. That's not going to matter. Is that going to make a difference on its own? No. What's going to make the big difference is the approach that he's going to bring, what he did or what he was a part of more so in Houston, the launch angles, things like that, the approach they took at the plate, that the Red Sox are the exact opposite of at their approach to the plate in 2017. That's what's going to make the difference. I'll hang up and let you guys talk.
Kyle, great point. And if you want to carry forward the Cassidy thing with the Bruins, it's not just that he was a new voice or a breath of fresh air, which he was. He changed the way they played. I mean, that's more important. I mean, what are we talking about? You know, how they come out of their zone and taking the ice and blah, blah, blah. So can Cora do the same thing as Mass? Because he make that big of a difference schematically where he makes a difference.
Well, so to me, this is why the Bogaerts comment stuck out. Like, again, it's Xander Bogaerts has the ability. Okay, he's got the ability. 6'1", 210, or whatever the hell he is, 205. He's a big enough guy to hit the ball out of the ballpark, and we've seen it. We've seen him hit the ball out 420 feet to deep parts of a ballpark. So it's not a question of strength. It's not a question of ability. But he swings like he's more interested in poking a single to right field all the time. And so this is why I think, like, when I hear Cora say, oh, the hitting coaches are working with him, you know, his posture, fine. You know, we're going to move his hands. Okay, fine. But the idea of being more aggressive, that I think can come from the manager. Send Bogaerts up there, and you say to him, why are you always taking these pitches? Why are you always taking fastball first pitch down the middle? Why? Hack at it. You're a good fastball hitter. Blast it somewhere. We're okay with that. And I think if he can change the way some of these guys think a little and get them a little bit more aggressive, it can make a difference, yes.
Let's go Connor in Westboro. Connor, you're up next with Felger and Maz. Go ahead, Jimmy. Pop him up. Hi, Connor. I'm sorry. Connor in Westboro. Go ahead.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good.
I got two Celtics points. One, on the Rondo versus Cassell thing, I agree I think that you guys are idiots. Cassell took 6 three-pointers in the whole series and missed. BasketballReference.com has Rondo rated as the fourth best player in that series, not in the season, in that specific series. They have Cassell rated 10th. He played 19 minutes. How can you say that one?
I'm talking about the whole playoff run. I just remember.
No, you.
I remember. Well, let me finish. In my mind's eye, when I go back and remember that team, and I remember who won you games and made an impact. I obviously remember Pierce, Carnett, and Perk, and Ray Allen more. I also remember Perkins more. I remember James Posey more. I remember P.J. Brown more. Hell, I remember a game that Leon Poe, who Phil Jackson then called Powell after the game, dominated. I mean, I remember Leon Poe winning a game. I remember Eddie House. I remember Sam Cassell. I don't remember a single thing Rajon Rondo did that entire playoff run. I don't. I remember subsequent years, but I don't remember anything from that year. He felt like a total sidecar to me.
Okay, so look, I hope Anthony and Lowell's listening, okay? Because what I'm going to tell you is what you remember about Cassell is wrong. Cassell was a bust, as it turns out. They picked him up, but see, Anthony and Lowell's also wrong because they picked up Cassell because they were worried about Rondo. Not for some veteran reinforcement. They were worried about Rondo. They weren't sure he was going to be able to handle the postseason, so they picked up Cassell. As it turned out, Rondo played better. It worked. They didn't have to make the move. But to say that Rondo was an influential or integral part of that team is wrong. It's wrong. He was a passenger. That's all he was. As much as anyone else was with those three guys, he was a passenger. He just happened to be the guy making the passes.
So my point is, him waving his ring in Isaiah Thomas's face, little silly. That's all. That's all. Brendan in Boston, I think the same topic. Go ahead, Brendan, line six there, Jimmy, if you would, please. Hi, Brendan.
How you going, fellas? I love the show. Look, I mean, I agree. Like, if we're going on talent, fellas, all right, big three, probably Perk and Posey, then Rondo, maybe even some other guys that year. But in terms of importance, fellas, let's look at how many different teams have had superstars come together in the past 10 years. Outside of LeBron teams, because he's a trump card that's going to win every year anyway, you really don't have any team that brought three random guys together or multiple superstars together that performed at this level. And I'd say, honestly, fellas, it's because we had this piece in Rondo who was willing to step back.
God.
No, stop. Let me say it, Felger. He's willing to step back and not worry about scoring at all and literally say, I'll facilitate the ball and let you guys learn how to play together and win a championship your first year together and go from being the worst team in the league or whatever it was, the second worst record in the league, to winning 66 games. Do you think that really happened, Felger, because it was just Garnett, Pierce, Allen, and the infinite wisdom of Doc Rivers? And how
yes.
he did with the Clippers and all that talent he had over there?
Yes.
Well, do you think that maybe there's pieces like Rondo that served bigger roles than you think? Because you just look at stats and you look at numbers, like Cassell playing 12 minutes a game in the playoffs and being brought in, by the way, Maz, as another...
I don't look at stats and numbers. I haven't looked at one stat or one number. I'm just remembering who stood out in that playoff run, and it wasn't Rondo. And I don't think Rondo was the key to bringing the big three together.
He wasn't that type of guy, but he did stand up 3 years later when he got comfortable. But what he was doing in that meantime in 07 was being he was the background guy. If you ask any of the players on that team, if you ask them, if you had guys line up on Sunday night and say, who was the most important player? The guys in the franchise, Danny.
They hated him.
They hated him.
You have no idea what you're talking about.
Five on that team, Felger. And by the way, Maz, if you want to get that fact straight, they brought in Cassell to be a backup point guard because we needed another ball handler. We didn't have another ball handler on the team at that time. That's why he's brought in. Also because Rondo was young, but he was still playing well. And like I said, fellas, I mean...
Brendan, I'm going to let you go there.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Look, whatever. We've talked about this all day. I think Rondo was an incidental piece to that championship. He was a more important piece later on, and the more important he got on the floor, the bigger jerk he became off, and he tore the team apart to the point where they got so sick of looking at his stupid face, they dumped him. So, yes, he became a more important player, and they also couldn't wait to get rid of him. But that particular year, incidental piece to that team.
I mean, The idea that he is the reason it came together quickly might be the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Okay? Seriously. I remember...
No, that's revisionist history, but it is funny, though. So the Celtics eventually couldn't wait to get rid of Rondo. Kind of like how Danny couldn't wait to get rid of Isaiah Thomas.
Totally different.
Okay, okay. So,
totally different.
Murray, just let me get
back up the Brinks truck. I'm getting mine.
Please let me get this thought off
my chest.
He does
not sound like Mickey Mouse. That, again, okay. is not true.
Hello, boys and girls. let me get this thought off my chest, okay? Because, again, I was there. I covered that pretty much that whole Celtics season.
For who, Mass? Who are you covering it for?
At the time, the Herald. I mean, I was a columnist at the time, but I spent a ton of time with that team because they were so damn good. And when they made the trades and when they made the acquisitions and all of it, everyone said, 3-year window, let's see how it comes together. They went to Europe, they did a trip together, and they bonded instantly. Instantly. And I remember vividly when I looked at them and said, oh my God, what do we have here? It was the third or fourth game of the year. I think it was the third. They played the Nuggets. They played them at home, and they were up at halftime 77-38. Okay? 77-38. I just looked up the box score. I remember it vividly, and I went, oh my God, they are loaded. You're telling me that was because of Rondo? The third game of the year. Rondo. Not you, Murray. I'm looking at you because Felger's not here.
Yeah, no, I know.
But like, the third game of the year, 77-38 at halftime, and that's Rondo?
But to say that he...
Kiss my ass with that. That was Garnett. That's who that was.
To say that he didn't matter at all is patently false. It is. I mean, he wasn't the most important piece. Far from it. That part I admit. Big three, Perk, Posey. But he mattered.
He mattered like any Joe average point guard would have.
They shot 65% from the floor that night. Right then and there, I went, this team's on a different planet than the rest of the league.
Felger and Mazz, the Sports Hub. This is Felger and Mazz.
I'm a sports dork now.
That guy is a hack.
Felger and Mazz on 98.5, the Sports Hub.
When someone stops you and asks you a sports question, is it about the Bruins winning the President's Trophy or the Celtics and what they're doing and how far they're going to go, or the Red Sox starting spring training, or is it, what is it?
Malcolm Butler and the Patriots, still. I mean, that still is hovering. There's some Patriots stuff overall, you know, with McDaniels and what's going on down there. But most people, honestly, still say to me, what happened with Butler? What's going, like, what the hell happened there?
Do you have any clear idea 2 weeks later?
No, I don't. I really don't. But I look, we've talked about this in the past. And what I do think it illustrates, because there's all kinds of crazy theories, right? Like, and one of the first ones out of the gate, and I say crazy theories, maybe they're not that crazy, but one of the first ones out of the gate said, you know, if there was an issue there, Patricia's leaving, so it's okay if he pisses off Belichick a little, because he's already taken the Lions job. So why didn't Patricia say, Bill, are we sure we want to do this? Are we sure we want to go with Eric Rowe, Johnson Batamosi, Jordan Richards over Malcolm? Are we sure we want to do that? And it doesn't feel like that happened. And we talked about this a lot in 2009 when the documentary came out and they sort of went down the drain after the Seymour trade, as much as they can go down the drain, that you wonder sometimes if the fact that Bill has so much power and Bill is so omnipotent, if that comes back to bite him in the ass, right? That there are times when Bill's consolidation of power is so great that no one is willing to step up and say, are we sure we want to do this? Like, is that really what we want to do?
Don't we have two glaring examples here? I mean, the Butler thing and then the Garoppolo trade. And, you know, he did run it up the flagpole to Robert. Robert told this to Peter King that, you know, Robert heard about it, was taken aback, asked Jonathan about it. Jonathan said okay, and so they went ahead, but he was taken aback. And so the Crafts could have vetoed that deal. In hindsight, they should have vetoed that deal. But do we have two recent examples of Bill really being unchecked down there? And do you wonder about that going forward? Like, I think that's sort of a developing opinion on that. And that is, do the Crafts have to, I don't know, insulate themselves? Maybe insulate's the wrong word, but keep closer tabs on Bill and what he's doing here, because there's been a couple decisions recently that sort of defy logic, certainly seem to fly in the face of what's best for the team, and really feel more like just sort of personal things for Bill. I mean, again, the Garoppolo one to me is more glaring.
Well, so and I mean, the Garoppolo one illustrates multiple levels too, right? Like, on the one hand, maybe Bill wanted to keep Garoppolo and they said no, so they intervened. So he was checked and he didn't react kindly to it. And then said, well, that's it. Screw it. I'm going to take a second-round pick, send him out to San Francisco, and I could have gotten more. And then he's unchecked on the back half of it. Going forward, I look at it and say, like, to me, where I'm worried is the next quarterback. Is Bill going to make that pick? Is anyone else going to have a say? Do we want Bill solely to make that pick when he might have 1 foot out the door? Like, I wonder about that one. And I wonder how much of this they want McDaniels involved in, really. It sounds like they do, because based on the stories that are out there, again, it's been a couple of times now that it has been leaked, whether it has been in something written by Ben Volen or spoken by Greg Bedard on our show on Tuesdays, where you hear McDaniels was instrumental and involved in the drafting and development of Garoppolo. Why is that emphasis coming out now? Like, and I wonder if the Crafts are looking at it saying, Bill, we're not going to let you pick the quarterback on your own this time. You're not going to pick him on your own this time because you're going to be out of here, and we want to make sure the next quarterback is someone the next coach wants, and that could be Josh.
So that's, I think, spinning it forward a little bit is an interesting dynamic, and that is the next quarterback is not really for Bill. It's for Josh McDaniels. And so McDaniels has to be heavily involved in that process. And then it comes down to who has the final say on that process. And after the way Bill has handled himself, you know, recently, do you want him making it? I mean, from a football standpoint, you want him making the call, of course. Like, there's no one more qualified to pick the next quarterback than Bill. I mean, I wouldn't want anyone else other than Belichick to draft and develop the next quarterback. But it's gotten a little squirrely down there, right? And so I just sort of wonder about that dynamic going forward. But the Butler thing, again, is, you know, I just, that Ben Volen line in his column on Sunday, Maz, where he says, the Crafts were as surprised as anyone that they only got back a second-round pick for Garoppolo and the Malcolm Butler story. They were as surprised as anyone. Meaning, again, taken aback, not happy with it, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I think all these sort of things, underlying things, are still sort of at play down there. I really do. On Malcolm Butler, can I just introduce this? Because
sure.
Our producer, Jimmy Stewart, you know, when he talks like this, I have to wonder. Okay? He says, on Butler, can I throw out this hypothetical? And whenever he says hypothetical, like, don't you just stop and go, okay, hypothetical.
On Jimmy Stewart underground source is what you mean, is what this is.
Well, about. He doesn't credit any underground sources or otherwise. He does not credit Nick in Boston or Cam in Taunton or underground sources or anything else. He just says, can I throw this hypothetical out there? And whenever he says something like that, I just sort of say, okay, here we go. Anyway, here's his hypothetical. During the pregame defensive backs meetings, Steven Belichick, the safeties coach, tells the defensive backs they want to use Rowe on Jeffrey Moore. Jeffrey doesn't run great routes and relies more on athleticism. The coaches thought Eric Rowe would be a better fit, but not completely benching Butler. Butler got pissed and told Steven Belichick, you'd be nothing without your dad. You can go bleep yourself. Butler had to be pulled away from Steven Belichick. Bill Belichick gets word of this and decides that Butler is benched for defensive snaps for the entire game. The point? Rowe was going to get more playing time to start, but once Butler handled the situation, as he handled the situation, Butler was not going to get into that game. Again, comma, writes Jimmy, just a hypothetical. .. Your thoughts, Murray, you're chuckling.
I'm laughing at the fact that it sounds like one of Jimmy's typical, like, probably informed type hypotheticals, you know? It sounds plausible, sure.
I mean, I'll screenshot my text messages for Twitter if you'd like. You didn't get it. I'm sorry.
So, I don't get it.
No, so look, like, it's not the first time I've heard this kind of theory, that maybe there was some blow up with one of Belichick's kids, in which case I say, well, this is why you don't have your kids on the staff. Like, you know, you're introducing potential problems there.
Well, so, and also the element of it being pregame, meaning, you know, this answering the worst part of the whole story, as far as I've been concerned from day one, and that is he got the uniform, that he was in uniform, that whatever he did wasn't bad enough to send him home. And so that to me is just, it's been the worst optics from day one. So this sort of explains it, that his role was diminished, he was informed of it after they turned in the inactive list, right before the game, in uniform, he flipped out. And that's why they held him out of the whole thing, but the uniform was on and the active list was already in, and so that's why he remained on the bench.
Do you buy it?
I think it's plausible that something like that happened. Okay. I still have no idea, but I do believe it was personal in nature, that Butler is not one of his guys, has not been one of his guys, and so Butler probably did something at some point that week, and Bill overreacted to it, because Butler's not one of his guys, and he was more than happy to bury him on the bench. And the fact that it happened right before the game, whatever he did, maybe that lends credence to, or explains that thing about him being there, you know, in the first place. If it's because he mouthed off to his kid, that is among the top five worst reasons you could ever make a decision. That is so Mickey Mouse, it's not even funny. I mean, for you to, as you said, first of all, put your kid on the staff to put you in a position where you're making some sort of family loyalty decision over what's best for the football team is just, that's why you don't have your kids on your staff, A. But when they're on your staff, you have to be able to separate that, because it's what's best for the team. Not what's best for the Belichicks. And now I'm like getting Bill in trouble for something that he probably didn't do. Like, this is just Jimmy throwing out a quote-unquote hypothetical. I'm just telling you, if it did involve that, it's still no reason to sit Malcolm Butler. It's what's best for the team. It's what's best for the team. And what happened that day was not what's best for the team.
I mean,
that we all know. And that's why that's still a lingering question. And the Garoppolo trade was not what's best for the team. It wasn't. It's what was best for Jimmy Garoppolo. It's what was best for the Shanahans, who Belichick is close to. But it's not what was best for the team. And so I just sort of wonder here going forward, is that why McDaniels, they made such an effort to keep McDaniels? Because, again, they need insulation there, or they need, you know, more layers here now because they didn't like the rationale behind Bill's last couple of decisions.
Well, and McDaniels has been with Bill for 15 years, right? So if there's anybody, you know, and there's a break in the middle, but if there's anybody that can probably communicate with Bill more directly, and we've already heard how many stories, you know, and the Bedard thing that we talked about the other day about McDaniels being a buffer between Brady and Belichick suggests that McDaniels can communicate with both. Right. So again, maybe this is a way for them to, maybe it's a way for the Crafts to communicate with Bill. Maybe they got to go through McDaniels. Like, you know, the way they might have gone through Belichick when Parcells was here, for crying out loud. There's a little bit of a tension point there just by definition or by nature because of the power of the two positions. So there's probably going to be some tug between those two guys, all of it. And I still find it astonishing that in the second half of that game, he didn't put Malcolm Butler in.
Okay, so we have sort of left the Patriots Palace intrigue to the side for the last 2 to 3 days. I just thought we'd just touch back, dip our toe back into that water because I still think it's a prominent thing in a lot of people's minds.
Stay tuned for more Felger and Mass on 98.5, the Sports Hub. This is Felger and Mass on 98.5, the Sports Hub.
Hey, Michael, I don't care about the Sox winning the divisions. I mean, they're boring to watch because they don't hit. The best Red Sox highlight moment of last year was when they had the tribute to the 67 Sox, and the kid from the Cape threw the first pitch and hit the photographer square in the mucklucks. And I'm looking this year, and the most interesting thing I see coming up is the Red Sox auction. And I'll let the pink hat internet bidding war begin on the lost Andrew Benintendi shower video from his agent's house. Thanks, Mike.
Okay, Martin. So that was a highlight when the guy got hit in the nuts. You know, this thing, I'm going back and forth on this, Maz. You know, Mookie Betts stepping up today and saying, you know, admitting to wasn't a happy place last year and there was tension. I mean, I can't remember the exact words that he used, but, you know, admitted that it wasn't a fun place and they got to have more fun this year and, you know, all of that stuff. But it was so miserable. How did they win 93 games and the division?
Exactly.
So it's like, it didn't get in the way of them winning. It did get in the way of them winning. So then you get to the postseason, and what? Because you're unhappy about manager John in July, you're going to suck in October. Like that makes no sense. It's just a cop out.
Couldn't agree. You know, the when you look at the whole thing, and you say,
"I'm sorry to have you agree with me, man."
I know, I caught myself.
I know, but it's just like I don't know how else to look at that.
So look, there's two ways. Okay, first of all, was Farrell a problem? Yes,
of course.
Yes, he was. But they won the division anyway. If they had won the wild card, you could then say, well, hell, 2 or 3 more wins. Maybe they win the division. They don't have to play the play-in game. Like, of course. Absolutely. Everything's different. No two ways about it. But the fact that they got into October, got into the division series, and then got their ass kicked for the second year in a row, if you're Mookie and Bogarts and those guys, who do you blame for that? Like, I look at that and say, no, stop.
Yeah, look in the mirror.
Totally.
And this is already annoying me because they were already oversensitive and whiny last year. And to me, this just proves they haven't changed.
They're soft. It's a soft team. They are. They're a soft team. And they don't have enough power in the middle of it. Maybe the power thing they can change if some of these guys hit their ceilings, but I doubt it.
We George need and Methuen? More fun. Oh, my God.
Oh, God. If I hear that one more time, I'm going to puke. George and Methuen, Jimmy, please, on line 2, weighs in on our Rondo Isaiah Thomas conversation. Hi, George.
How are you, Mike? How are you, Tony? So, Mikey, don't listen to this clown green teamer. Like, who was B.J. Armstrong for the Bulls from 91 to 93? I don't know. I think I remember more John Paxson than B.J. Armstrong, and he was the starting point guard. Rondo had 3 Hall of Famers. 3, not 1, 3 Hall of Famers. There's no way.
Thank you, George. Good call.
Thank
Good point.
You. Yes.
Appreciate it. Yeah, appreciate you, babe. To me, but again, the whole thing is still hysterical that these guys are going at it over some video. I mean, that's still like the crux of it. Like this 30-45 second highlight video that they were going to play during the pregame introductions is still like this tension point among these guys, both of whom were wildly overrated and both of whom are nowhere near as important as they think that they are. And they go toe-to-toe last night. And the worst part is they both get thrown out, and so we didn't even get to see them go back and forth and to see who would actually, you know, win that thing. That's the real crime. Let them go. Let them play. We've got Nathan in Connecticut. Jimmy, please, on line four on Malcolm Butler. Hi, Nathan in Connecticut. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. What's going on? I got a crazy theory for you. Would you think Belichick would sacrifice a Super Bowl to shove it into Kraft and Brady's face in order to prove him that when they made him trade a Garoppolo?
So I'm going to let you go, Nathan. I'm going to let you go. So first of all, at no point do I think or have I ever said or will I ever say that Bill was willing to sacrifice any game. He thought he was going to win. Okay, he thought he could bench Butler and win. Period, story over, and he was right up until the 2:13 mark when Brady got strip sacked. Okay, because if that doesn't happen and Brady gets rid of that ball to James White in the flat, or well, he just hangs on to the ball, they're probably going down and winning that game. All right, so Bill thought he was going to win the game. It looked like he was going to win the game up until 2 minutes were left, and so he's not. He didn't sacrifice squat. Okay, two. This is Murray's conspiracy theory that Bill felt emasculated having his power taken away in the Garoppolo thing, and he chose this opportunity to reassert the fact that he runs the football team, right, Murray?
Yeah, I just feel like, and it was, you know, it all came to a head at the worst possible time. He kind of lost his mind. He felt like he was losing control because for the last 3 years, he's seen his quarterback become bigger than the team. That goes against everything that he stands for as a football coach and everything, you know, that he believes in terms of the hierarchy of a football team. So he decided, you know what? This player is out of line. I helped make him 3 years ago. You're sitting. And that's it. And I'm not going to go back on it. And it ended up, I think, helped cost them that game.
Whatever it was a grotesque overreaction. It was an overreaction. Did he have his reasons? I bet he did. I assume he did.
But to not swallow your pride and put him back in the game in that second half is just, it's unforgivable is what it is.
2.5 weeks later, I know it's still... It's hard to wrap your head around.
This is Felger and Mazz on 98.5, the Sports Hub.
Felger and Mazz.
They're more scared of you than you are of them.
98.5, the Sports Hub. Sports Hub. Sports Hub.
Sports Hub. Sports Hub. Cleveland has screwed so many things up. They've screwed up coaching hires, the Isaiah Thomas trade. They butchered number one picks like Anthony Bennett. But because they have LeBron, today they're better than Boston. Boston's done everything right. They win every trade. And they're still not as good as Cleveland. And that just shows you the power of LeBron.
Well, no, I just heard Colin Cowherd, but that didn't sound like he was going off on one of his crazy analogies or making some sort of, you know, crackpot theory. That sounded pretty normal to me.
Well, let's play the whole clip then. Maybe you'll change your mind.
Okay.
You know, I was thinking about this morning. They wrote a book years ago. It was called The Millionaire Next Door.
Right.
And it was, you know, live below your means, use coupons, pay off your mortgage, pay down your debt, buy used cars.
Yeah, he might be a little high already. But this is
okay. So here we go. Here comes one of Colin Cowherd's. You've got to be baked to sort of follow along with the analogy. Continue.
All the prudent moves, and you'll be successful. And that's what the Celtics are. They have a smart, engaged but quiet owner, veteran, respected general manager, brilliant head coach. Accumulated all these draft picks. They win every trade. They're the millionaire next door. They've done it the right way. They've saved their pennies. They don't waste money. They don't have bad contracts. They accumulate draft picks. The Celtics are the millionaire next door. So how frustrating must it be that Cleveland, who's got terrible cap management, an ego-infused owner, horrible contracts, chemistry issues, below-average head coach, blows their roster up, and this morning, Cleveland's still better than Boston. I mean, the Celtics are doing everything right. They're pulling up in that used 2007 Camry that gets great gas mileage, and they live below their means, and they're paying off their debt. They don't have any credit card debt. And here are the Cavs. They took out a second mortgage to buy a boat and everything that shouldn't work. But you know what? They're the ones, because they got in on Bitcoin at the right time. It doesn't matter. They can screw up every other investment. That's the power of LeBron. I mean, like, Cleveland has screwed so many things up. They've screwed up coaching hires, the Isaiah Thomas trade. They butchered number one picks like Anthony Bennett. But because they have LeBron, today they're better than Boston. Boston's done everything right. They win every trade, and they're still not as good as Cleveland. And that just shows you the power of LeBron.
Man, he is a trip.
Thank you. So somehow the Celtics and the Toyota Camrys, second mortgages for boats, Bitcoin, and Anthony Davis, they're all sort of wrapped in there, Murray. Did you follow?
Yeah. I mean, the Celtics are trying to build this responsibly and slowly, I think is what he's trying to say. And meanwhile, the Cavs are your neighbor who just, you know, spent $10 on a scratch ticket and they ended up hitting it big. But they've hit it big because they have the best asset of all in the league, and that's LeBron. So you can continue to screw up and make these goofy moves, like trying to add the multi-little peanut to this team, and it's not going to work. But because you still have the best asset, well, you can risk it again and make another goofy move, and this time it seemed to have paid off.
So this is the problem with the NBA. All you got to do is hit the lottery, right? Bingo. You got to hit the lottery, and then everything else is irrelevant. So, but ultimately, look, I told you, I think those four teams in the East, and I include Washington, I'm sorry, because I just think, hell, that series won seven games last year. So I include them, and I say they're all pretty close, but LeBron wins because he's LeBron.
Yeah, and I think Maz hit it. That is the issue with the NBA more than any other sport. You can do everything right. Coach well, draft well, be smart, and it means squat. It means squat. Like every other sport. You know, football, a coach matters. You can outthink an opponent with a game plan. Or hockey, you can, you know, out-effort a team. You could beat a team that's better than you just with superior effort. It's the way that sport goes. You know, in baseball, like these things, you can out-strategize, out-think, out-hustle, out-coach, out-work. You know, do all these things. You can do all these things right in other sports, and it pays off. You do all these things right in basketball, and if you don't have LeBron, you're poor. That's what sort of sucks about the NBA. The question is, now with the Celtics having lost three straight, and like, what's their current streak? Like 7 of 12? Like, what they've
6 and 9 their last 15.
6 and 9. Okay, so they're 6 and 9 in their last 15. They've fallen three games behind Toronto in the loss column for the first seed in the Eastern Conference. Three losses. They're three games in the loss column behind Toronto now. Boy, that was quick. As we hit the All-Star break, are you beginning to worry, Murray? Big Jim worry that the Celtics aren't as good as we thought they were.
No, this is a lull, and they have some issues, especially defensively. And I think some of the young guys, like Brown and Tatum, are definitely hitting the wall. And I'd like to think that they can figure this out after the All-Star break. I have to think that they're more of what you saw in the first couple of months than what they've been over the last month.
I mean, I am a little bit worried, but again, I thought that they were going to have problems when they get to the spring anyway. But I look at it and say, man, like, The drop in play significantly by Brown and Tatum to me is pronounced. Like, you know, you sort of go into the season saying, let's see if they can keep it up. They're playing great. And then when the drop comes, you go, oof, I didn't expect the drop to be that much. So I'm more worried about them offensively than defensively. This thing that they're going through right now.
I sort of agree with that, but go on.
Yeah, I just think that this is, you know, the break's coming up. Mentally, they've checked out. You know, they don't give up 125 points in the last two games when they're playing hard. It's just borderline impossible for them to give up that many. So it tells me they've checked out. They're already in the break. Coming out of it, and in the spring, I know there'll be effort there on the defensive end. I just don't know if they're going to get secondary scoring.
Yeah, it's too small a sample size, but these last three losses, all at home, they've been brutalized, especially like last night in the paint. The defense has been bad. Even the game against Indiana that they crawled back, they're down 26. I mean, it's been ugly. And this team last night, I mean, I think that's pretty much a bad L.A. Clippers team. And they start Austin Rivers, who should be in the G League. And you give up 129 points to that team, like, it doesn't look good right now. But I have to think, again, like, bigger picture, they're more of what you saw the first few months of the season than what you've seen over the last 15, 16 games.
And I'll just say again, I think the standings are significant. I think home court in the playoffs for a team like the Celtics is significant. You know, for some teams, it wouldn't matter. It wouldn't matter LeBron going on the road, you know, the last 7 years in the East Finals. Doesn't matter to him. At this stage of the Celtics' development, it matters. So, Celts, Toronto, Game 7 on the road, that's a big difference. That's a big difference for this team versus being at home, or obviously home road versus Cleveland. I think that goes without saying as well. So, you've fallen three games behind Toronto. And now Cleveland's sort of coming, and you're falling back. So just watch all this. If you finish in the 2 or 3 seed, remember, that means you probably get Cleveland in the second round, not the conference finals. It's entirely possible that you, just in terms of how far you go, could take a step back. If you're on the road in the second round, and again, I don't think you'd be on the road against Cleveland, but just play it out. If you have Cleveland in the second round, home or road, and they've gotten their act together, You could be done in the second round this year versus the conference. I mean, that's sort of plausible. So I watch those standings. I watch the wins and losses. And so the Celts hit the All-Star break, and, you know, you're sort of wondering about. But if you ask me, they're still the same team. They're still coming out of the East. I still believe that. It's a lull. It's not an up, you know, it's just an up and down in the season. It's not anything fatal, and it's not an indicator. They're closer to what they were at the beginning than what they've been at the end of the first half. That's what I'll tell you. So that's sort of resetting our Celtics thoughts just on the team in general. We also got into the completely ridiculous Rajon Rondo, Isaiah Thomas nonsense with these two fighting over a 45-second highlight video for someone who ultimately is not going to matter in Celtics history, and Isaiah Thomas being spurned by someone who's not going to matter in Celtics history, and Rajon Rondo.
But has a ring.
But Pete Nessix wants to weigh in on that. Go ahead, Pete. Jimmy, I'm sorry. Can you help me outline five? Pete Nessix is up next. Go ahead, Pete.
So I'm a fan of anyone that can piss off Kryzaiah, but just looking back on that season, Mike, I don't know what's in this race, but just to give it to you, that championship season, Rondo was fourth on the team in games, game started, minutes, field goals, scoring. He led the team in assists. He was fifth in rebounding. And in the finals, he had 16 assists in game two. And after having six steals in game six, Phil Jackson called him the star of the closing game. So
yeah, he also called Leon Poe Leon Powell. And so, wait, hold on. You're saying Rajon Rondo led the Celtics in assists during the regular season? Hot tie, let's raise the number.
Yay.
But Mike, you can't. I said I didn't have a horse. I'm just giving it to you. But you can't say he wasn't a factor, and you also can't say Sam Cassell was more important, who played 17 games.
Okay, so the regular season I don't care about. They were a wagon in the regular season, and I didn't say that Rajon Rondo. Well,
Rondo started every playoff game, and his stats were the exact same in the playoffs as they were regular season.
Hey, Pete.
I don't care about the stats.
Pete, when Miami won championships with LeBron, who was the starting point guard?
Dwayne Wade.
No.
Mario Chalmers.
I don't know.
Yeah, Mario. Right, exactly. That's exactly right. You don't know.
I did.
All right. Well, here's something that helps. Here's something that helps Jimmy and I's case. This was sent to me. This was a recap of Game 5 Eastern Conference Finals. The Celtics ended up defeating the Cleveland Cavaliers back in 2008.
Eastern Conference Finals?
Correct. East semifinals. Sorry.
Do you want to double check that? I mean, it's again, because we're dealing with facts, so we're just throwing it. I mean.
Sorry, East semis. I'm going back 10 years here. I have to look at it correctly. East semis. All right. All right. Jesus. Celtics went into the locker room trailing by just 3 points, despite allowing LeBron James to score 23. Rajon Rondo was the reason they were right back in the game. Quote, Doc Rivers, these were shots when they go in, you love them. They probably gave him confidence. He had a great feel for the game tonight. Did he ever, goes on this ESPN columnist. Rondo was the primary difference maker on offense with 20 points and 13 assists, and the Celtics turned up their defense intensity on James, physicality on everyone else, on and on. Rondo played the entire second half and logged more time, 42 minutes, 10 seconds, than any other Celtic, and Boston regained command of the series and moved one win away from moving on to the conference finals against Detroit.
Every dog has his day.
Well, he didn't matter at all.
Any point guard could have been on that team. Any average point guard. You have someone who really sucks, maybe that holds you back. But when I say Rondo did nothing, I mean he did nothing above what your average point guard would have done with that team.
But he was,
that's all.
He was a part of a championship team. He has the ring, so he has more cachet than the mouthy little peanut who was only here for a blip in the annals of Celtics history. So I can understand it rubbing him the wrong way when a guy who really doesn't matter in the long, illustrious history of this team is trying to dictate when he gets the video. No, I don't want it that night. I want to make sure my family's in town that night before I get traded yet again for spare parts.
Hello, boys and girls. It's Mickey Mouse. Yeah,
he's given Isaiah Thomas a Mickey Mouse voice. Who has more juice? I mean, they're both juiceless, but who has more juice to you, Maz? Isaiah Thomas or Rajon Rondo?
I told you, to me, it's like a coin flip. Like, seriously, I look at the two of them, and you can chuck them both out the window as far as I'm concerned. Murray, how come you didn't bring up Game 6 of that Cleveland series? Why'd you pick Game 5?
Well, because it was sent to me, Maz. Why? Well, what did he not do
Murray
in Game 6?
Murray didn't even know what round it was.
Oh. Because in Game 6, he scored 2 points. He had five assists and 3 turnovers. He sucked, and they scored 69 points.
Well, it's a long series.
Exactly.
There you go.
I'm just telling you, listen, he was a passenger. He was a passenger the same way, Jimmy, that Mario Chalmers was on the Miami Heat. My Mario Chalmers. Nobody talks about Mario Chalmers when we talk about the Heat of those years. It was LeBron, Wade, and Bosch, just like it was Garnett, Pierce, and Allen. Rondo might as well have been sitting on a saddle on Kevin Garnett's back, because that's all he was a passenger.
You do Miami Heat talk when we're on down in Miami, okay? You do that on your own time.
You're listening to Felger and Mass on 98.5, the Sports Hub.